The EMS Educast is a podcast by and for EMS educators. Every week, our panel of education experts hosts a program that brings you the latest and greatest in EMS education technology, methods, and techniques. Your hosts will regularly bring you guests from all over the world to tell you about innovative EMS education programs and experiences in other places. Join us each week for the EMS Educast. And visit www.emseducast.com to subscribe with iTunes or the RSS feed, listen to archived shows, and view future show descriptions. The EMS Educast.
Everyone, this is the EMS Educast. On behalf of Bill Toon and Rob Terrio, this is Greg Fries from a semi-secret location amidst the fall colors of central Wisconsin. It has just really been a gorgeous fall, warm days, cool nights, and just spectacular colors on the leaves in the trees. And I am just always so grateful that I have an office window that looks out into the out-of-doors and right into the leaves and the changing colors. Rob, what is outside your office window?
Oh, it's beautiful. I overlook the campus at Georgian College with trees and grass and a little lake just down the hill.
Okay.
It's beautiful. Beautiful.
Wonderful.
It's about 20 degrees here now, which I think is 70-ish
Yeah,
Fahrenheit.
That sounds about right. So 20 Celsius. Yeah. Here's a little tip. I don't know if everybody knows this, but if you use the Chrome browser, you can convert units right in the Google search bar. So if you convert, if you typed into the Google search bar, convert 20 degrees C to Fahrenheit, it would pop up right away with that. You can do the same thing if you want to go pounds to kilograms or deciliter or like deciliters to liters or gallons or any number of things. It's really a handy little way to use the Google search bar that I found out not long ago. So
that's cool.
If you're listening to this, you could type that 20 degrees C and let us know what you found out. But Bob, how long have we been talking, Bill? I've just messed up your name after 180 some episodes. Bill, what's outside your office window?
Oh, you know what's outside. You've seen it. We have a demonstration garden that's maintained by the Case State Extension. So I have an absolutely beautiful garden that I look out of all the time. And it's volunteers come in once a week and maintain it. So I have a beautiful view.
And you're in one of those LEED certified green buildings too, right?
Yes, absolutely. Wonderful building. Quite spectacular.
Yeah, that's really nice.
Is that a LEED silver, LEED gold?
We're a gold, I think, but there are some other buildings that are platinum or whatever the highest level is.
Huh. Mm. I've just exceeded all knowledge I have of LEED by just saying it's LEED certified.
I think gold has to have geothermal heating and cooling and solar panels of some sort. I think silver, which is what our building is, just has to have natural lighting and some other greenish things.
Huh. I can't hear silver and gold without thinking of Burl Ives singing silver and gold in the Christmas classic about Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Jeez.
But
great. Now everyone's going to have a tune stuck in their head.
And that sort of funny looking snowman moving across the fake snow. I think we had sort of a Burl Ives-ish laugh in the background there a moment ago. Dan Limmer, welcome back to the EMS Educast.
With a preamble like this, I can say nothing other than it's great to be here.
Well, good. I am curious what's outside your office window.
Well, it's kind of dark right now, but Stephanie has quite a perennial garden that is sadly a little out of season here, but we have a beautiful yard here in Maine. It's much chillier here, but it's fall is a beautiful time with the leaves as well.
Yeah, are you near the ocean?
Not as near as I would like to be. I'm as near as I can afford, which is a couple miles.
All right,
but it certainly is very close, and we get the weather benefits and a very short trip to enjoy it.
Well, excellent. One of the things I enjoy, and Bill probably gets this in his garden there, is the perennials. Is, you know, this time of year, the migrating birds that, you know, one morning you'll look out and there'll be some little pack of birds that you haven't seen since spring, and they spend the part of the morning, and then they flitter away, and they're gone for another 9 months or something. So neat times this time of year. And then also welcoming back to the EMS Educast a many time guest and even an occasional host, our good friend Angel Burba. Angel, welcome back.
Thanks, Greg.
And since I've asked everybody else, what's the view from your office on campus?
It's actually really nice. The brand new building that we just moved into in January kind of has an odd horseshoey kind of shape, but not really, but sort of. And so I look out onto part of the building, but then to my immediate left, I'm looking at the quad where our new science and technology, our new STEM building is going to be built. That's our next big building project. Okay. And then right behind that is the hospital for Howard County. So I get to see all that. And my office faces west, so I get to see gorgeous, gorgeous sunsets.
Excellent. Well,
I like that. And are they actually going to call it a STEM building?
Yes.
Oh,
science, technology, engineering, and math. Okay.
Yeah. Although actually, M kind of has its own building right now, so it'll probably be maybe STE. I don't know. Okay. But you know, everybody's big on that. But our building is actually LEED Silver.
LEED Silver. Mm-hmm. And do you know what that means to be LEED Silver?
I know quite a bit of it. Yeah, it exactly what Rob was saying. It has to do with the carbon footprint that you leave, the amount of natural lighting that you're using, the airflow. It's all of that's built into it. But it's actually very, very difficult to earn the level above silver, apparently, because we were trying to go for it, and you have to have a certain amount of points, and we're somewhere in the 60s, and you need like 90 points to hit the next level. So we were not able to attain the next level, but it's a beautiful building. I'm really, really thrilled with it.
Sounds like it might be worth a visit someday. I hope I could.
Yeah, you got to come and see my ambulance simulator. We're all thrilled about this thing.
Wow. Well,
Wait, I just checked. It's a gold. I'm in a gold certified building. So not silver, gold.
Is that what that typing was in the background? Was that you?
No, that was not I.
Oh, okay.
So if you were typing, one of you, make sure you mute when you type or you're not talking. And then LEED, oddly, is LEED and not LEAD, correct?
Yes.
All right. So we'll look forward to maybe in the show notes, I'll try to put some link to the difference between LEED Silver and LEED Gold and LEED Platinum. And I think I'm in LEED Cardboard here.
Nice.
It actually has a lot to do with gaining grants and federal support and things like that, too. So it's kind of the vogue thing to do right now.
Excellent. Well, the purpose of our call and the reason that we're so glad to have both Dan and Angel on the show is, listeners, you'll recall about 10 episodes ago, Bob Sullivan came on the show. And this was episode 178, from field provider to full-time EMS instructor. We talked about Bob's upcoming transition from field provider, like I just said, to becoming a full-time instructor. And as we talked about things that challenges he was looking forward to and things that he was going to be doing to be successful, it occurred to me it would be interesting to look at this same challenge from the other side of, when you're the program director or administrator, and after you've hired somebody to become a full-time instructor or maybe even an adjunct faculty in your program, how do you bring them in to help them succeed in your program? So that's what led me to contacting Angel and Dan, two educators that have probably helped bring up lots and lots of new instructors or bring instructors into their programs. So, other than that, I don't have much other way to frame this, other than maybe just to start with. Rob actually asked me the other day, he said, well, what do you mean by onboarding? So maybe I'll put that question out to the four of you first. When you hear this term onboarding, what comes to mind? What are sort of some of the things that might be involved? And then maybe from there we can get into best practices or things that have worked or not worked in the past. But what comes to mind when you hear that term? And maybe we could start with you, Angel.
Okay. What I think of is taking someone who, in many cases for me, has been referred by someone else, by someone whose opinion I trust and value, and they'll say, hey, this person is asking me if you know, you have any openings, or you know, they want to know if you're hiring or whatever. And so sometimes I don't know these people, but what I think is really important is with this whole idea of onboarding is a lot of people can teach, but we've got to find people that embrace our culture and are going to approach a similar philosophical way of doing things. And so we just kind of, you know, have those conversations up front about some of the temperament kind of things that are really important to us, and also looking at what environments they've already been in and telling them, you know, how the college setting, the academic setting is might be slightly different from fire department training academy or a hospital-based system or some other place that they've come to, but just sort of talk about those philosophical things. Because I think a lot of people can be brought in, but they have to fit. And you got to give them a chance to fit. And so that's what I think of with the onboarding. It's just that whole cultural piece.
I think, this is Dan here, I think that Angel, you know, through what you said, brought up a good point, is that there's a lot of different environments that instructors can be brought into, a lot of different types of training programs. If you're in a different type of allied health program, respiratory, you know, nursing, you're largely always in a college. You might have some, you know, other kind of program, but largely a college. One thing that's interesting about EMS is that we have so many other types of training, from, you know, from trade schools to the back of the fire station to community programs to regional programs. And I think that there's a lot of, probably a lot of the questions that we answer tonight are probably going to have different answers based on where that training takes place. Not everybody has the angels of the world leading a program and talking about things like, you know, our vision and culture. I think other people are largely trying to get somebody in the classroom at 6 o'clock tomorrow night. And there's a, like I said, I think there's a lot of different definitions to onboarding depending on where we are and how people will respond to it.
Mm-hmm. And Angel, do you have a process, a formal process for new full-time faculty who come in, like a formal orientation that they go through?
Sure. The college absolutely has that. But we also, actually, a majority of my workforce is part-time hourly, who on occasion I can give credit load to, but they're mostly part-time hourly. And I think that's the reality just in these economic times. A lot of programs have that same reality. But we do, I've taken a lot of the things that HR has. You know, we have the, of course, being a college, we've got the whole HR department, but we've adopted a lot of the HR processes. And it's actually kind of interesting because when I do payroll, the people in finance that are in charge of payroll, you'll see them send out these messages, and it'll be to, you know, the distribution list and Angel. It's like I'm tacked on the backside of this because I have such a unique situation, because everybody else in the college doesn't have the same situation that I have. And it literally is, you know, office managers and Angel.
That's flattering.
No, it's nice. Scary because they didn't even think about me for the longest time. And I'm like, why isn't my payroll getting processed? And finally they went, oh yeah, you're different.
So what are some of the things in that orientation process that the college has laid out, and then what parts of it are you customizing it for the needs of your hourly adjuncts?
Well, everybody has to watch a certain amount of videos that have already been placed on the website, and they're tracked, and you know, you have codes that they put them in, but there's like five of them everybody starts with. One of them is access and responsibility, which deals with privacy and FERPA. And then everybody has the obligatory sexual harassment video that you have to watch. We have a health and safety one that deals with, you know, the fire alarms and all those sorts of things. And then I'm drawing a blank on what the other two are, but there are five of them.
What's
and then after,
FERPA?
Yeah, after you, FERPA is the Family Education Rights and Privacy Act, I believe. Okay. It's the old Buckley Amendment. That has to do with One of the conversations I have with parents, in fact, is, you know, we can talk all day long philosophically about things connected with your kids, but once this person enrolls at the college, I can't talk to you anymore about their performance or anything unless that individual is present and they've given me permission to do that. So when the helicopter parent calls up and, you know, why is my child failing? I can't say if your child is failing or not, but I'd be more than happy for you to bring them in and we'll have a meeting. Okay. And that's all about the privacy that that individual has. I can't, even though we have some waivers for people who are sponsored by the fire department and things like that to disclose grades backwards, it's very controlled over what we can say to people other than that individual.
Huh. All that time, I thought a FERPA carried your bags in the Himalayas.
That's awesome.
I like to contribute to all these podcasts. I contribute everywhere I go.
So remember when I said I was having a cough because of allergies? You just gave me an asthma attack. thanks, Dan. Sorry, Angel. I derailed you, and then Dan really took us off the path there. The one of the things, I guess, maybe continue you were talking about the sort of set of videos and then about to get in some of the other steps that are involved.
Yeah, after they've done those things, then they are, you know, kind of given the keys to the certain things that they have. They get, you know, introduced to security. They get their parking pass. They get tours. We introduce them to the office staff, and we sort of take them around and show them everything that we're responsible for, and we introduce them to key players. And honestly, the key players are the custodians and the public safety people. You know, those are the ones that in a pinch are going to be there for you. And so I always make sure I introduce them to all those folks in our building and that they know their names and they realize how important those people are. And then we have, you know, a certain amount of policies and procedures, dress codes, rules regarding fraternizing with students, those sorts of things. We just kind of overview those policies and those procedures. And again, we've sort of got them all. Some of this is loosely structured, perhaps, but we have this list. And by the time we've brought this new person in, I've checked off all these elements on the list. And then that's where kind of it just starts with the in you know, training the trainer instructor pieces, but that gets them in, that gets them brought into the college.
And do you have a social media?
I was Rob, say, please ask, go ahead. Do you ahead. Have a social media policy?
We do, but it's actually fairly loose, and it's actually been very liberal, and we've. We within our program have tightened it up a little bit more based on a lot of the things that we've seen happening on, because myself and my faculty members, we, most of us as a policy, don't friend students. But of course, you know, anybody that's savvy can see all of your conversations anyway through friends of friends of friends. And if you don't do all that fancy stuff to exclude it. So we're still very careful. And we FERPA is very important to all of us. We don't talk about students. When we do, it's we'll spin it so that you don't know we're talking about a particular class or a particular group, because there are a lot of really interesting conversations I see people having on Facebook about even trying to problem solve or just sort of share problems that they have, and you know, what would you do about this? And I think that's a really valuable thing, and I don't ever want to see that stifled, but I think we have to be really careful how we approach it.
So now to slip in my question here. How many full-time did you have, but the majority you have, are they part-time or contractual?
Part-time hourly, so they're not even really contractual. But right now, this semester right now, I have two EMT cohorts. One is like 15 students, the other one is 25. And then I have two I2P cohorts of 15 each, and then I've got my paramedic cohort of 15 that's going on right now, and then in the spring I'm going to have another paramedic cohort start, and so we've got about 90 students right now just this semester that we're dealing with across the various cohorts that we have. I have 20 part-time hourly people that, because of all of the impact of the Affordable Care Act, are limited to, I think they said 30 hours a week or less in their time that they can do. And then I've got, I'm a full-time FTE, a full-time faculty member. I have one other full-time FTE that operates my other site. I have a satellite training site, and he's full-time up there. And then I've got a staff, full-time staff person who is my clinical coordinator. I have a half-time FTE that, because of the budget right now, is currently not filled, which I would love to get filled right away. But I'm begging for people. I mean, I've got 15 or 20 people sitting there in the HR process that I just don't have the time right now to sit down and process. So I've got a lot of people in the pipeline, but it's just, we never seem to have enough. Back to somebody mentioned in the beginning, trying to get somebody, I think Dan said it, getting somebody to be in the class on Saturday night. I have those exact same issues on a fairly regular basis. People commit a semester out, and then, you know, my $20, $27, $28 an hour is not going to compare to the $200 or $300 of overtime they're going to get in the fire department. So then I'll lose every time when that happens. And, you know, I've let people go, but you can only do so much of that. And then you're cutting off your nose to spite your face when you're letting a lot of people go because they're choosing to do the overtime. So it's tough.
So do you, what do you expect out of a new instructor? So someone comes in to be one of these part-time hourly, do you have a minimum expectations that you have before you put them through the videos, which could put some people in a catatonic state, and then your checklist that you have?
I do, but it's we're of the philosophy that we will give people a chance to develop themselves. So we've had some people who have been pretty raw, and actually some of our most consistent and supportive faculty that we get are actually people who are graduates of the program, and they'll go out for a couple years and then they want to come back and teach. And those are the ones that really make my core group right now of faculty. But every once in a while, someone will come as a referral from somewhere that is just that gem, that diamond in the rough that we know we got to have. And then, you know, Maryland is a small world, and I'm sure you all have this. There's sort of that group of undesirables that kind of go from program to program to program, that you have to deal with those folks as well. But most of them that come to us are pretty well, they're good clinicians. They're not always necessarily skilled educators, but they're good clinicians. So then I spend a lot of time chatting with them about what do you think your strengths are and where are you comfortable? And then we kind of launch them from there. So we will oftentimes team teach them, you know, and I can only get by with so much of this because of the budget, but I'll have them team up with another person who's really strong as an educator and have them mentor them through it once or twice in like a skills lab or something. And then we'll go back to that person and we'll say, okay, well, you know, now you're going to take the lead. And so we'll then have them take the lead, and then the other person sort of monitors what they do. And then we cut them loose after that, provided they're doing an okay job, we cut them loose. But we never have a situation where, even when we're doing testing and things, there's always someone in the room overseeing what's happening. Either myself as the program director, my clinical director, someone that's a more senior person is sitting in the room, although they might not actually be doing the testing, but then they will intervene when things start to happen.
Angel, this is Dan. Do you think that what you're doing is more or less or about the same as other programs out there? You've certainly been out there and around enough to do that. I have my opinion, but I want to ask you first, where do you think you stand on the spectrum of what you do compared to what other places do?
I think it's similar, at least from what I've talked to some of the other programs here in Maryland and the way they do things. I think it's fairly similar. Maybe we do a little bit more mentoring, but I think we're kind of similar. What do you think?
I would think that you probably are on the higher end of things. I think that the videos and the college structure and stuff, I suppose there's a lot of places that can do that. But I think that there's a lot of sink or swim out there. I think that there's a lot of people that don't have anywhere close to enough people and bring people in and don't have anywhere near the structure and the safety net that you try and put out there and develop people. I think it's really important stuff. I think a lot of people want to do it. I think some don't have the means. I think some don't know how. And I think others just don't really have the time and they tread water.
Huh.
Dan, what about the, you mentioned earlier sort of the different contexts, and I was thinking, as Angel described the sort of series of college-related training, I can imagine many situations where somebody joins as part-time faculty or contract instructor with the college, but never actually like steps foot in the college. They do all their teaching out in fire departments and EMS buildings sort of around the college's catchment area. How do you, and I think that's part of what you were addressing, how do you sort of bring that person into sort of like, yes, you got to do this stuff, and then continue to help them feel like they're part of the college education program, even though they never actually step foot in the college?
That's, you know, that's part of the culture, I think, that Angel was talking about. And what I think is difficult for a lot of places is you don't have the bandwidth to go out and be that safety net for people. When people go out to teach, you send them out. I also agree with Angel. You have a lot of great clinical providers. Many of those are good educators. But I think where, when we send people out to outposts and other places without supervision, where I find, I think people need the most help and sometimes get into trouble, isn't the teaching. The two parts that I think are the biggest issues are organization, because we're kind of a short attention span crowd, and the other is administration and dealing with discipline problems and ADA problems. I think that the teaching sometimes become, when it comes down to issues people have, generally aren't the big things. It's the big picture issues that do that. I think those outposts have a lot of trouble dealing with that because they really are out there. And if you are, you know, I've come from a lot of small places in Maine. There's a lot of, you know, small places. There's regions out there and there's training centers, but, you know, nobody's sitting around saying, oh, gee, you know, the economy's great and we have lots of help and we have all the money for it, because that, you know, that really isn't the case. So we have a lot of regional training. We have a few colleges that offer, but I think that we're a little bit of the extreme up here, and that people are put out there without the preparation they need. And I think big picture is the problems that people fall into is in the attention span, is the teaching an individual class is one thing. Guiding a class from the first day to the last day and getting them what they need is vision, and that's different. And then dealing with some of the problems, I think that's where we have the biggest issues and the biggest fails, when we don't do the training properly.
I think that word you used, outpost, is really intriguing. And Rob, I'm curious this, if it's a Canadian aspect. I feel like it's pretty common in the States where EMS education happens very far away from the college. Just in Wisconsin, I can think of many places where classes are taught 50 or 100 miles away from where the program director is. So simply the logistics to get out to a class every now and then is very difficult, let alone to provide any sort of adequate supervision or mentoring. Is that the case across Canada as well?
So it depends on the province, but British Columbia, for example, is a relatively small province population-wise, and they have about 800 full-time paramedics and maybe 2,000 part-time, and they have one institution, the Justice Institute, that does all their training. So they go out and do service-based training, and I think it's a mix of weekdays, weekends, that sort of thing. But as far as I know, the rest of the provinces are very similar to Ontario. We have a very we don't do any outpost or out of campus training per se. It's all Monday to Friday, all at one campus, so we don't have those kind of logistic problems. But we have the same challenges with respect to part-time staff who, you know, they kind of get neglected in the whole system. We bring them in. It is a bit of a sink or swim. They go into a lab typically or in a clinical, and they're learning by the seat of their pants and with some, a little bit of assistance from the other part-time faculty. Our full-time faculty who come on have a similar kind of orientation to what Angel described. They do orientation training one day a week for a full semester, where they go through principles of adult education and all the other things as necessary to be prepared. Yeah, it's really quite good, and there's a mentorship involved in that as well. So they pair up with another faculty member and they sit in on their classes and talk about different teaching strategies. So it's really quite good. But the part-time staff, I think, are always the ones who get a little neglected in the process because there's a turnover.
Yeah, and what happens is when the program director hears of something, it's because there's a problem, and that creates intervention rather than a prevention strategy.
Mm-hmm.
So, is in the in Maryland, is there any state credentialing of instructors?
There is. We've got it's the Maryland Instructor Credential Review Board, or the MICRB. And that's based on the NFPA standards of instructor from the fire side of things. And you have a certain amount of class time, 40 hours or however long that is. And then you have, in that class time, you're doing presentations and developing curricula and those sorts of things. And then you, after you've completed that process, you then have to teach roughly 60 hours, and you have to have two sets of evaluations, one of a skills type focus and then one of a lecture type focus, although a lot of us are blurring the lines these days on those. But you try to have, you have to have those two evaluations, and then you put your package together and you submit it and it's evaluated. And then every 3 years, you have to recredential yourself with at least 12 hours of continuing education. And ironically, because of the way the Maryland statutes were written, that actually was the reality at the BLS level. And we didn't have that same dynamic at the ALS level. And so it was never really written into the Maryland regulations how you would do that. But now we have an ALS credentialing process as well. But prior to that, it was sort of the medical director and the program directors. There was a list of things you could get checked off on. And back when we had the different modules of training and like the 15 modules throughout the old national standard curricula, you would be able to go module by module. And then based on your experience, they would evaluate that and they would say, yes, you can teach this, this, and this. And kind of the big joke in Maryland was you could basically, as an ALS instructor, pretty much get signed off for everything except for like the couple little pediatric things, which was sort of in the domain of our PALS people. But everything else you would get credentialed to be able to do. So, but now there's a slightly different process at the ALS level that's more like the BLS level.
Is there an expectation of your part-time faculty to get that credentialing?
Yes and no. It is certainly, you're not going to be a primary instructor, meaning you're not, in most places, you're not going to be in charge of the EMT class unless you have that MICRB credential, at least in our shop. We sort of wrote it into the regs and the policies our advisory board has approved. They really want to have that MICRB credential. It just lends credibility to our process, so we kind of insist on that. But then on the other side of that, we also have been working with continuing ed for a while to just try to get our head above water enough to be able to do some other things to actually host some of those classes at our program. And so then we could actually do the courses in-house.
So just out of curiosity from anyone there, do you think that if we were to compare ourselves to the nursing program or the dental hygiene program, do you think that there's an equivalence with our instructors to their instructors?
I actually have firsthand knowledge on that. The nurses at my college are all master prepared. That's the way it's written, and that's the requirement. However, there is a nursing educator credentialing process that is tested. It's a testing type process and portfolio and assessment and things like that, but it's not required. And actually, our nurse faculty are in the process, some of them, of attaining this. And so I've sat down with them and talked about it, and it's actually what they're doing. I find is actually a couple steps behind what we've been doing in EMS already with the stuff we do at NEMC and things like that. That they're just now catching up to us, which I thought was kind of interesting.
But do you think it makes a difference that they have a higher expectation of the primary education the instructors need to have, other than they probably need to be licensed nurses, but also to have to have a master's degree, compared to EMS, where there is no degree requirement necessarily to be an instructor, particularly once you leave the collegiate environment?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, you know, a while back, to get a master's prepared nurse educator was very difficult to do because they wouldn't take the cut in pay. And now things have kind of changed a little bit around the nursing thing. I mean, it was quite an issue several years ago to try and find the educators that do that. Now, for us, you can be a program director for Coimbra Accreditation with a bachelor's degree, master's preferred, and you can't find the master's degree people. You wouldn't have a lot of accredited programs. So obviously, we have a little bit of a different scale in that. I don't know if I would say that. I don't know. I think that the master's that people have in nursing isn't necessarily an education.
Right.
So I think there's a lot of issues that come into play there. It's a little bit apples and oranges, also because of the fact that you really don't get a nursing degree or a nursing, license without finishing a degree program. Where in EMS, that's much different. I think that we have come a tremendous way recently with accreditation, with courses like the NEMSI course and the quality of education that's out there, and are recognizing as a profession that this is necessary. But we still, I think that would be very difficult to compare it right across the board and come up with a conclusion on it.
I've had this discussion with some of our nurse faculty at Georgian College as well, and it's interesting because some of the part-time nursing faculty, they have their BSCN, and in order to become full-time faculty, they have to have a master's specifically in nursing, so profession-specific. And some of them, have said, I'd really like to do a master's in education, and would a master's in education not be more relevant? But our program, I think, is very similar to others in nursing anywhere, where they have to have a master's in nursing. And it seems that way at all the community colleges that people come in with profession-specific degrees, but don't have the teaching background. And so, the assumption is that they come in and because they have the knowledge and experience, they can teach, but they really need that additional adult education piece.
I just want to steer the conversation back to our friend Bob Sullivan. And imagine this scenario that, you've hired somebody like Bob to be a full-time instructor in your paramedic program, and we're about 6 to 8 weeks into the semester. What do you think Bob should be good at by now as a full-time instructor? And what kind of encouragement or what areas do you think somebody like that is probably going to be needing to focus their energy to improve on during the rest of the semester? Where should he be by now, and what should he be doing to get better in the weeks ahead at sort of this point as a new paramedic instructor?
The one thing that I taught Bob, by the way, at GW many years ago. I think it was 2001, 2002. Really, really sharp guy. I'm very happy for him. I think one of the things that changes when you come from a provider to an educator, the concept of having a desk versus an ambulance. I think one of the things that has to happen is you have to have a lot of long-term vision, a lot of strategy. You have to be very organized. And when you're going from call to call to call, when you go home, there's nothing else to do or to think about. There's no long-term stuff. I think one of the core things where educators fail, and I've said this before, and I am challenged myself from time to time, is to be able to go for the long haul and picture the class from start to finish as a long-term project, as opposed to from the call-to-call environment that you came from.
Yeah, I think until you get into education, you don't realize just how staggering the work is. It is exhausting when you're starting out. And that's probably the biggest challenge for somebody like Bob, I would think. Greg, when you asked where do you think Bob should be now at 6 weeks, and my immediate thought was treading water. still.
That's what I was going to say.
Just keeping his head above water and planning, you know, one day at a time, more or less, until he's got his first year or 2 years under his belt.
If you think about it, I mean, all of us on this podcast can open our computers and probably find a lecture on most anything that we could do. But imagine even, you know, creating your, not only, you know, going in and having, I'm not sure if he has any administrative responsibilities or what he's doing, but then also the content preparation on top of the big picture stuff. You know, if you've been doing it for a couple of years, well, you always update your things. You've got it, you know, you've got your stuff, you open your computer, you've got some work done. But in the beginning, you have all that to do as well. It's really huge. Mm-hmm.
Which raises the question, I'll pose this to Dan first and then to Angel. What's your feeling about sharing your lecture material or your slides with a new instructor?
I think that the paramedic class that I taught last time, I probably was a 1 day a week for a year kind of thing. So let's say I had 40-something sessions. I probably used slides 5 or 6 sessions. And I have a legal pad and I have bullet points and notes and stuff scribbled and I write on the board and I give them assignments. And I think that the instructor of the future, when we talk about flipped classrooms and lots of other stuff we're not going to do tonight, I think that it's going to be more challenging because, you know, I mean, I write books and we put out slides, but the slides can't be the same thing to everybody. Even if I were to give Bob my slides, which I would gladly do, he still has to make them his. I think the concept of slides hopefully is on the way out, and we're looking at more active models and, you know, case and problem-based learning and all those things, which is even more work for Bob, sadly. I would share anything I had with the educator, but I would tell them when I gave them the disc or I emailed the file, is, you know, take some time to make this yours. All too often people say, oh, boy, there's nobody coming in tomorrow, and I get somebody's slides, and the first time they've seen it is a half hour before class, and that's not the way to do it.
Yeah, it's always great to hear feedback when someone's using your slides and one of the students tells you, oh yeah, so and so is using your slides and they came to this slide and said, I have no idea what this means, let's just go on to the next slide. Yeah.
That's the first, if I borrow anyone's slide, that's the first thing as I do is I go through and I take out anything I clearly don't understand.
Yeah, Angel, what's your feeling?
I completely echo exactly what Dan said. I mean, and he said it better than I probably would have, but I just 100% agree with him.
You guys are so much nicer than me. I used to share my slides. I can't do it anymore.
Why?
Yeah, because I've had instructors who borrow the slides and never change them, though I asked them to. I went to a conference in another province once years ago, and a speaker gave a presentation using my slides verbatim. They hadn't even been changed, except my name had been removed. And I guess part of it is, you know, when I first started teaching full time, I developed a program from scratch, and I spent day and night weekends prepping. And I see new instructors come in, sometimes full time, and they just don't seem to be willing to put the effort into it. And so I know that's not the case with all people, but I've just reached a point now where I can't, it really pains me to say no, but I say no.
Well, I mean, you probably have some intellectual property. You know, for example, I shoot a lot of my own photographs and I don't share the photographs. If I share something, mm-hmm. I give a stripped down version and people have got to then, you know, therefore make it their own because that's my, you know, stuff. And I don't want this, you know, rotten.com or someplace, you know, seeing, you know, trauma photos I've shot myself. And I think if you looked at, you know, what someone has paid to do the slide program that goes with any of our books, right, Angel? I mean, people are paid for that. I mean, thousands mm-hmm. of dollars. You really have intellectual property and stuff to be proud of. I don't think it's necessarily bad. And you're also not the only person that's had stuff basically ripped off and done at a conference as well. I think it's a dual-edged sword for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I aspire to create slides like Greg Fries's slides because Greg Fries has simplicity mastered. And I mean, that's the perfect kind of slide. And if someone were to borrow those, they would have no clue what to talk about because it's one slide with one image or one word, which is fantastic for presenting. But
Greg, didn't you base all that? Aren't you a presentation Zen person? Isn't that series of books?
I did long ago, read some of the presentation Zen. And, I've just really worked hard to and a lot of influence from Kyle Bates and John Dillon and just to try to really make it my own. And so that the slides really don't stand on their own very well. You know, they need a presenter. And I just want to go back to this idea of, when I asked you what Bob should be feeling like right now, and everyone's like, oh, he should be overwhelmed and treading water. And I think that's probably accurate, but that's also certainly like risky for the program, right? We've invested a lot of time and money as a part-time faculty and then hiring Bob and then like, here you go, like feel overwhelmed for a couple of years. Like,
but you know what though, Greg, I think even though we recognize that happens, I also think, and I, cause I know I've done this, I made the mistake of assuming that because this person, these people were veterans, fairly well seasoned, I might be intrusive in interacting with them or in, you know, it's like, oh, here comes the boss and now she's sitting in the back of the room and what did I do wrong? And, you know, I actually noticed that with a lot of my faculty, I would drop in and, hey, how's it going? And I mean, it's just like a deer in the headlights. Like, what are you doing in here? What am I doing wrong? Do you need to talk to me? And they would like stop in the middle of class. I'm like, no, keep going. I'm just checking in. And so there's that whole, there's just that whole kind of thing, that dynamic thing. And sometimes they wouldn't come to me when I was waiting for them to come to me. It's like I would know that something was brewing because my clinical director is excellent about being the eyes and ears of things. And she knows exactly what's going on all the time. Somebody coughs in the fire department and she knows it. I mean, she's just great. And she'll know about all these things going on. And then she'll come in my office and she'll be like, you know, we need to talk for a minute. And then she'll tell me exactly what this other person didn't have the whatever to come in and tell me. And then I'll go over and I'll tell them, you know, let's, and sometimes I don't even tell them that I knew or that she tipped me off or whatever, but it's like, they're like afraid to come in and tell me. And I'm sitting here going, if you would have told me in the beginning, this would have never bloomed into what it's become. You know, just everybody's going to make mistakes. And I always tell them, you're honeymooning for the first class, for that entire class, until you submit the grades and we debrief, you're in the honeymoon for that entire class.
I would say, with the exception of the honeymoon, everything Angel said, if you took out parents and if you took out instructor and program director and put in parent and child, it's all the same, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You know, what are you doing here? Am I in trouble? Am I doing things? And nervous if you're watching and how you give feedback. You know, I think there's a certain part of structure that is both appreciated but dreaded at the same time by people that come in part-time. They want the freedom, but they appreciate the structure, and I think that's quite a challenge, I'm sure, Angel, for a program director to do that.
Yeah,
I would just add for new staff, I think it's important to have weekly lunch meetings where once a week you get together and they can pose questions. I mean, oftentimes the questions for new faculty is about content. You know, I taught it this way. Is that how you teach it? Is that, am I right? Am I wrong? And you know, instead of just letting them off on their own and never seeing them again. Because I don't know about where you work, Angel, but my campus is huge, and we're all over the campus. And so I might not see other instructors for weeks on end unless we schedule meetings to get together, even casually.
Yeah, I've got my other campus is 25 miles away now. And I've got an issue actually up there right now with the student that's brewing. And this kid has decided that
FERPA. Remember FERPA?
No, it's not. I'm not going that deep.
I'm sorry.
But he's decided that, you know, without even ever sitting down with me, that I'm going to respond a certain way to something. And it's like, I just want to have a conversation with you. You know, just come and sit down and talk to me. And it's just really gotten really odd. But thanks for the reminder, Greg. But no, I wasn't going to go into too much detail.
Well, I just felt like I should work that into conversation now that I know what it is. Rob, you led into an area that I want to go as sort of my final question for the group. And you mentioned a weekly lunch meeting, and that's something I'm wondering about. Like, what are sort of esprit de corps that we can be doing with, you know, whether it be the full-time faculty or all the contract faculty that might be part of the program? You know, what are some other team building or esprit de corps things that work in your programs or other EMS education programs you're aware of?
Well, I think, you know, in addition to the standard what's happening in the classes this week, where, the, you know, who are the at-risk students, that sort of thing, I think it's really good to set aside some time during that lunch period to brainstorm and come up with new ideas. I think that really helps to team build and make new staff feel like they're part of the decision making and the vision for the program. I would say that would be part of giving that esprit de corps.
Any specific activities, events, Angel, that you do to build some team?
They're all invited to the advisory board meetings, and they're considered to be on the advisory board, so they contribute there. We also have planning meetings before semester, you know, like 2 or 3 months out before the semester starts. We'll have one or two of those, just kind of based on the workload. I usually take notes in those, and then when I go back to my office, I make sure that I type that up and distribute it. And so it's like, here's our list of action items, and you were going to do this, and you were going to do this. And then I have to follow up on that to make sure that they do. I also do, like Rob, I try to take them to lunch, and I actually try to make a point of making contact with them at least monthly. You know, maybe not on a real continual basis, but at least monthly, just to sit down with them before the class starts. And I try not to go after class because everybody's always so tired. But, you know, before the class starts, and I hold those meetings when it's convenient for them. You know, I would love to be a 9-to-5 person, but I can't. So we pick a time that works for them. And, you know, I'm not going to ask an adjunct to come in here on a day when, you know, they teach on Tuesday and Thursday. I'm not going to ask them to come in on a Wednesday. So I try to work around their schedule more so than mine. But yeah, just the temperature taking and the course correcting kind of things. And then we always have a debrief meeting at the end as well.
Dan, how about you? Any team building?
Well, I think that one of the things I've seen is is sharing expertise does a couple of different things. You've got somebody that's a peds person, somebody's a trauma person, somebody does something else. By having other parts of the program jump into a different part and teach gives that course instructor a little bit of time. It shows off the talent of the faculty, even the program director coming in and walking the walk and being there, coming in and doing a lecture when there's time, obviously, to do that. I think that by sharing expertise, sharing a little bit of the workload, and having people, if you have someone that comes in, does a great job and teaches something, other faculty, especially new faculty, can model after that. That there's something simply about lending a little bit of a hand, a little bit of an ear, you know, coming in and just walking the walk, I think, is a really great way for a new person to experience quality, to build the team, and also to be able to sit back and watch for a day or a half day or a night, whenever your class is. I think that I'm not trying to be, you know, corny here, but I mean it takes a village approach by getting people involved, I think, can be very helpful.
Bill, how about you?
What I did is I did some things similar to Angel. Is there was always a meeting before the beginning of each semester where we covered what was going to be done and major milestones and stuff. Of course, they were encouraged to come to any guest lectures. They got discounts for you know, anything that we could get them to get a discount for and stuff. We tried to do for that. And the other thing we tried to do is pay them a good salary. You know, that made a big difference. And anytime we asked them to do something, they certainly got paid. And that's always been is a big thing. And what we tried to do in our area, we weren't dealing with the fire department. We were dealing with other EMS agencies when I was teaching full time. So we created a salary that was a sliding scale dependent upon experience, but We did it so we were paying at minimum time and a half, and then it increased up there over what the average paramedic salary was in the area.
Well,
that's great.
Bill or Rob, do you have a final question or comment for Angel or Dan?
No, I don't think so, but Dan raised an interesting question earlier about whether Angel's program was typical of other programs across the state and across the U.S., and that's a question I would have as well. As you know, you often wonder what kind of consistency or lack of consistency there is for helping out new faculty. But I think, you know, this is a good topic of discussion for a group like NAMC to, you know, sort of build a framework around what, I mean, other than the instructor courses and that kind of thing, but to build kind of a rubric on what new faculty need to help them get through the challenges. Because it is, you know, I think as Dan mentioned earlier, it's such a dramatic departure from the field, and people don't realize how overwhelming the work is to be an educator, especially in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Dan and then Angel first, Dan and then Angel, a final comment or even a question for the rest of the group on this topic before we get to the wrap-up phase.
I think this was a great, I think it's a great topic, but I think in the grand scheme of things, we brought up a lot of points and a little bit of how to solve them. You know, for people like Bob, who's a really talented guy, it's quite a challenge. I think for the educators that are listening here to this, you know, to reach out, to lend a little bit of a hand once in a while. Sometimes we eat our young, and that's not always the best way to do it. There's enough good to go around to reach out for people, to offer a little bit of a hand, a little bit of you know, confidence building. I think it goes a long way. There's a lot of experience out there, and I think people need to share that with people that are new.
Yeah, I think also getting involved in instructor societies. And I, you know, we talked in the beginning about what's happening in nursing or some of the other allied health. You can seek out those collaborations, and there's a lot of really nice resources out there on, you know, making the class exciting and doing dynamic things. And, you know, a lot of Bob Pike's work with his presentation stuff. And there's just a whole lot of stuff out there that is not necessarily EMS-centric. And I think sometimes we feel like if it doesn't have the star of life on it, that, you know, it doesn't have any value for us in the classroom. And that's not true. And a lot of times those collaborations is, you know, go to a conference that has an educator track, even if it's not an EMS. You know, go for something for nursing or for one of the allied health, you know, physical therapy, whatever. And you're going to get exposed to unique and interesting ways of doing things. And I would also say that any of us who are mentoring people need to be really careful to encourage those people to build from their own strengths. Don't turn them into little yous, you know, because we can be really boring and annoying and whatever. That we want them to build upon their own strengths, and that's what I think we need to focus on.
It's a great point.
I agree. I'm just writing that down, Angel, actually. Build upon your own strengths.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of like martial arts. You got to take a little monkey kung fu with some tiger chi or something. I don't know.
You've been watching that Kung Fu Panda movie, haven't you, Rob, with your kid?
Well, she's 12, you know. That's what we watch. What can I say?
I think we do try and build people under our own, you know, what we think of ourselves to do that. I think, you know, if we look at probably the biggest factor I'd want in somebody is I would want a little bit of sincerity, and I'd want a real desire to teach. And from that, you can do anything, you know, but it doesn't have to be like you. Some people are just funny when they teach. Some are sincere. Some are just so clinically knowledgeable. You just have to sit and listen to them. There are so many ways to be effective, and nurturing any one of those and recognizing it is a challenge. Sorry to jump back in there.
No, you know, I remember when I was starting out, there were like five people that I was like, that's who I want to watch. That's who I want to be like. And, you know, Dan, you'll be embarrassed, but you're one of them.
Oh,
Scott
God.
Bourne. Seriously, Scott Bourne, Mike Smith, Twink Dalton, and Tagman. And it's like, you know, I would just go and just be enthralled in just watching these people work the room and watch what they did and watch what was good and watch what was bad and watch their comfort and all this kind of stuff. And then somewhere in about a year or so into that, I started feeling more comfortable in the classroom myself. And then I was watching these people and I was like, well, I'm just as good as they are. And I started getting like snarky about it. And then I realized this is really bad because I have stopped hearing their messages because I'm critiquing their performance. And I said, I got to stop doing this. And that's one of the things I share with my new people when they come in. I said, you are more than welcome to watch these other people, but don't you dare start critiquing them to the point where you have lost their message and you're not hearing what they're saying and you're just spending all this time. Well, they said 17 times and they did this and they did that. You're never going to grow if you keep yourself in that.
Wow.
And it's so common to go through those phases too.
Yeah.
It's good to come out of that and take the attitude of know not what you know when you watch other people teach.
That's a phase. It's a phase in itself. It's mastery and it's confidence. Once you realize you don't have to build yourself on things, you know, you get to a point where you're starting to feel your oats a little bit. I think it's really natural. But then you get to the step that Angel's talking about. And you know, my way to say it is, there's a lot of good out there. I'm not competing with someone to speak at a conference. There's a lot of ways to do things, and I think there's a lot of really good people that are coming up out there. And I you know, support that wholeheartedly. But it takes a while to get to the point that Angel said, where you're securing yourself and you're doing that. And it's a good place to be. Not everybody gets there, quite frankly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We've reached the point where we got to wrap up this episode of the EMS Educast. We're so grateful that you've been on. But before we go, we'd like to wrap up with a recommendation or endorsement or some piece of news that you want to share with other EMS educators around the world. And we'll include links to these in the show notes, listeners, so you can find at emseducast.com. And remember, if you ever want to recommend something to other EMS educators, you can go to facebook.com/EMSEducast. So, Bill, do you have a recommendation to kick us off?
I have this spectacular recommendation, except I'm not going to be able to give you the link until tomorrow, and I'm not even going to remember exactly the name, but I've come across an evidence-based website that pushes me rates and ranks the evidence, and you can customize it to the discipline that you want. And of course, I've got mine set for emergency medicine, and almost on a daily basis, I get an email from them telling me what is the what's this particular article, what did they weigh it at, and then they do a summary of it. And I have found it very useful, so I'll make sure that I share that link with you and about to do that. So, and excellent. Rob, no, that doesn't appear to be it for me, but if that's another one, that's great.
So, Rob, you've just typed into the Skype chat asana.com. What's Asana?
Yeah, that's completely different. So I'm on the planning committee for a couple of conferences coming up in 2014. And for one of them, we're using Bootcamp, which is a project management software. It's pretty good. But for this other conference, we're using Asana, which is a free project management software. And it's really great for team building, not just for planning an event, but for also probably good for planning a year with faculty in a program, just, you know, putting out tasks and putting timelines for them. And every time someone contributes to the project management side, everyone else on the team gets an update. So so that's my recommendation, asana.com.
Excellent. Is the other one you're using Basecamp and not Bootcamp?
I'm sorry, Basecamp.
Okay,
correct.
Great.
Yeah.
I just have two real quick things. Everybody, I'll include links in the show notes, but we have posted our four episodes from the EMS World Expo podcasts that we recorded. There's also videos there, so if you want to see the video of the conversations that I had with guests there, and then I'll include a link that the 2014 NEMSI Symposium call for presentations is open, and I want to mm-hmm. say that the deadline's been extended to like December 1st, and every year there's the evaluations say things like, oh, we need more people that haven't presented before, and we need new and fresh and exciting faces, and you know, 37% or so of this year's presenters were actually new first-time presenters. But the best way to get new presenters at NEMSI is for new people to apply. So throw your name in and your application for that, and we'll put those links in the show notes. Dan, do you have something that you would want to recommend?
Oh, you may have something that I would talk about. The we actually today just did a soft release on a product called EMT Pass. We're thrilled that Bill Brown, when he retired from the registry, came and is working with us. So we basically have an app that's been put out and written by Bill Brown. The app actually has almost 1,000 questions and 20 hours of audio recorded by Bill, where he actually narrates and explains why the right answer is right, the wrong answers are wrong, and talks about you know, the test question thing. So it's called EMT Pass. We're rolling it out now to the iTunes Store and Google, and our site is lc-ready.com, LC for Limerick Creative. And it just we started out just today, so we're really excited about that. I think it's really going to change things. You know, not only do we have the quality of the questions that someone who's been there for so long can do, but the audio, not only for the insights, but for the learners that aren't getting through with the reading, they can listen. I think it's going to be really hot. And to be really fair is that everything here is originally written by Bill, so nobody gets their panties in a bunch. This is totally original material. Bill is a man of incredible honor that would never, you know, do anything like that. So we're really thrilled about this. I think it's going to be a really big app. So thank you for the opportunity and thanks for having me.
Yeah, great. And we'll look forward to learning more about the EMT Pass app and from Limerick Creative. Angel, how about you?
Yeah, I've got three of them, but I'll be brief. Okay. The first, these are all apps. Two of them are apps. And I don't know if anybody's ever talked about this one, but it's called Priority Matrix. And there's a freeware version, and I've actually upgraded now that I've been using it for a while to the you know, the one you pay for, but it's not that much. It's only a few bucks. But it, what it does is it allows you to project manage stuff using the process where you have the four quadrant approach, and the two parameters are criticality and urgency. And so you basically sort things based on how critical and urgent they are, critical, non-critical, you know, urgent, not urgent. And then you end up with these four quadrants, and it kind of helps you prioritize just by just that sorting process. And then within that, you can do all kinds of tracking. You can share these projects. It's just really been very helpful for me with organizing, actually. And I carry my iPad with me to meetings now and just input stuff right there directly. The other one is Dashlane, which you might have heard of. It's a password management, and it's supposed to be all encrypted and all the, you know, the high level stuff. But I had all my passwords on, you know, Word document, and I was like 4 pages of passwords, and of course that's not real secure either. So I just finally put on my big girl panties and started using technology. So I really like Dashlane. And then the other thing, when I was at my last residency with this past summer for my my school program that I'm in, everybody was on the staff was pushing Carbonite or some other sort of way of backing up your data online. And I recognized the wisdom in that. So I was like, well, I have my external hard drive. And so she pulls out the one that, you know, got run over by the car. And she's like, yeah, here's mine. So it's like, okay, point taken. So having that Carbonite has just been a whole nother level of comfort for me as I'm keeping all this stuff for my dissertation. It's there. It's secure and I can access it anywhere.
Yes, I am also a huge fan of Carbonite because it backs up all the time.
I have a question. Do you work exclusively on Carbonite, or do you have files on your desktop or laptop and then they just sync automatically to Carbonite?
Well, they do automatically sync, but I don't store anything on my computer. I never have. I've always had an external hard drive just because I haven't the mobility of going a bunch of different places. But now I also back up that device to Carbonite as well.
Yeah, I store locally, Rob, but it backs up to Carbonite in the background, and then I actually said Carbonite will even back up my Dropbox folder, so
it's automatic.
Yeah, it just is happening there. So,
and all you just see a little green dot or a yellow dot on your folders on your desktop, and it'll be yellow, and then the next thing you know, it's green, and it's like, okay, don't have to do anything there.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks everybody for these recommendations, Dan. Best of luck with that release of EMT Pass, and Angel with all the stuff you've got going on, and Rob and Bill as always, and then Bob Sullivan, I hope things are going well for you, and maybe we've given you a couple things to keep in mind as you make it through your first semester, and We'll look forward to having you back on the EMS Educast. On behalf of Dan Angel, Bill, and Rob, this has been Greg Fries for the EMS Educast. Please connect with us at emseducast.com.